Mark Kermode, hello, good afternoon.
I was going to say, did you miss me, but you weren't here?
Well, I missed you for the week that I was here,
okay.
And the nation missed you.
And is it bad form to congratulate you? On your nomination?
Oh, I see, yeah, probably.
Okay, I won't then.
Yeah. It's an industry thing.
Okay.
But we do
I
have
was impressed.
Thank you.
So it's my wife.
Saul Dibbs is here. His debut feature film is Bullet Boy, getting rave reviews. Hello, Saul. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
We have a somewhat truncated conversation due to unforeseen circumstances. Let's get Mark to explain the area of the movie, and then we'll talk more about how it was made and so on.
So it's a film which I only just saw recently because I was off last week, and I managed to miss it at the London Film Festival, where it caused a big stir and a lot of interest in it. It's a story about a guy who gets out of jail and goes back to his community and has to decide between, without wishing to give away the whole plot, has to decide between, on the one hand, taking the righteous path, and on the other hand, going back into the life of crime which initially put him in jail. It's a story about young black men in Britain. I was very interested to see that Philip French, who is my colleague at The Observer, he's the film critic of The Observer, gave it a very, very good write-up in which he talked about it as part of a tradition of black British cinema, which, of course, is interesting because Saul, who's sitting next to me, clearly...
He's white. He's
white. And I thought it was a very powerful piece of work. I like it very much. I thought it was very interesting. And Philip made a comparison with Boys in the Hood, which I am a big fan of, although John Singleton, I think, kind of didn't go from strength to strength from there. But it's a tough, gritty, urban drama about, you know, problems faced by young men. I don't know entirely whether it should be classified as a black film, because I think, for example, when I was watching it, certain parts of it reminded me of Ken Loach. There's something to do with the improvisational dialogue, which is rather Loachian. It has a beautiful soundtrack, not the kind of rap music soundtrack, but who did your incidental music?
It was Neil Davidge and Robert Del Nair from Massive Attack.
Lovely, and really sort of lovely incidental music, and it's shot by a guy who's worked with Michael Winterbottom on many Winterbottom films. I think, did he shoot nine songs?
He did, he went on to shoot nine songs.
Okay, but he shot a whole bunch of other stuff before. Yeah. No, it's a very, very fine piece of work, and it has a leading performance by Ashley Walters, who of course is Asha D, although actually I have to say the standout performance is a kid who I'd never seen or heard of before, who I believe hadn't acted in films before.
Gentlemen, we'll do some more in just a moment. More details of our latest first and for free screening here at 5 Live. It's the one a lot of people have been waiting for, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. If you don't know...
People of Earth, a round of drinks for everyone on me.
And that would appear to be something that wasn't
42.
To do with The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Anyway, if you need to know what The Hitchhiker's Guide is, well, frankly, don't enter the competition. but if you need a few more details, Stephen Fry will explain. Or not, as the case may be. Anyway,
I could do an impression of Stephen Fry.
No. I mean, Stephen Fry is a very good idea to replace Peter Jones as the book, because he was great mates with Douglas Adams, and there's something about Stephen Fry which is very Adams-esque. Anyway, if you'd like to go to the premiere and the post-premiere party, which both happen next Wednesday in London, we have two pairs of tickets if you can answer this extremely straightforward question. So this is to go to the premiere, wear your best clothes, and then go to the post-premiere party. For which geographical features did Slarty Bartfast win his awards? Played rather splendidly by Bill Nighy in the movie. Yeah. Anyway, for which geographical features did Slarty Bartfast win awards? It's 0500 993 if you want to take part in this. Two pairs of tickets to go and see Hitchhikers. Which geographical features did Slarty Bartfast win his awards for? Would you know that, Mark?
Yeah, of course I would.
Do you
know
the first? Answer it?
No, I'm not going to answer it. Do you know the first person I ever interviewed as a journalist in Manchester was Douglas Adams?
It's a fine thing to put on your CV.
Yeah.
Saul, would you have known that?
I wouldn't, actually, no. I'm looking forward to finding out.
Okay, so that's the competition. We'll give you the answers and the winners before the end. And just trust us, Stephen Fry sounds great as the book. Reviews to come, and we just started talking about Saul's programme, which opened last weekend?
Yeah, last weekend.
On Friday.
How's it doing?
It's doing very well, actually. We opened on 75 cinemas around the country, which, for the kind of scale and subject to this film, was a great success to start with.
Why was that a great success?
Well, I suppose that, you know, it's not something that's made with a lot of money, and we tried to make it, you know, as kind of honest and as true to life as we felt. You know, it's not something that's necessarily a kind of blockbuster. This is something that, you know, deals with the difficult issue of kids growing up in a world where there are guns. So it's not something necessarily, and also because of the approach that we took, it's not a big sensational, glamorous, jokey kind of gangster film about it. It's quite, in a way, it's quite a kind of serious and or low-key take.
Where did the story come from?
Well, it's just something that I've been thinking about for a while, really. I mean, obviously, you know, having guns in the hands of kids has been around for quite a while. But it just felt that, you know, in a sense, here were all these stories that you hear about these things, and I wanted to do something that somehow just got behind all of that, got behind some of the kind of prejudices we have about people who pick up a gun and shoot people, and try and make a film from a family's perspective.
Is it about black-on-black violence?
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting point that Mark said earlier. I mean, you know, the story's fairly universal. It's about young men, macho young men, refusing to back down. And in a way, obviously, that could happen anywhere. It happens anywhere around the world. It's happened kind of time immemorial. The difference now is, you know, there are guns available, and when guns get involved in a situation like this, it escalates very quickly. And obviously, you know, there are, you know, lots of situations where young black people have got involved.
Well, I think the thing is, in answer to, you know, is it a film about black-on-black violence, it is true that all the key protagonists are indeed black, but I don't think the film has a specifically racial approach. I didn't make it. This is just from having seen it. I think that it is possible to ghettoise those issues and say, well, that's what it is. And actually, when you look at the history of black British cinema, you go back to things like, for example, Young Soul Rebels and Welcome to the Terror Dome, of which I don't think anyone feels, you know, hugely proud. But the nice thing about Bullet Boy is it is a universal story set in an environment which makes the story credible. You actually believe that these people could be in this particular position. When Saul was saying, you know, it's not lively and frothy, it's not to say that it's in any way dull. I mean, there are some very touching and tender scenes. There's that lovely ice skating scene, which is right. Which is,
yeah,
really sweet. Actually,
important.
I have to say, I thought the best scene in the film which moved me very much, was a scene in church, which is there's a whole subplot about a preacher who's trying to, you know, help the family come to terms with the terrible cycle of violence that their family is caught in. I thought that was very moving. I could almost done with seeing more of that. But it's not, obviously it's not a laugh riot, but in the same way that Ken Loach's films aren't a laugh riot, or, you know, actually Mike Leigh makes a lot of comedies, obviously. But I think it is, I mean, Loach for me was the key touchstone there, with the exception of the fact that Loach doesn't have soundtracks that sound that lush.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of our kind of my jokey initial pitches was Cares with Guns.
Oh, well, there you go.
So, you're absolutely right. But also not to do, you know, to try and make it, well, look, this is about a kind of serious issue, subject, in a way that's there, but not to say this is an issue film. You know, this is a film you can go, hopefully, and enjoy as a film in itself, and if there are things you want to think about afterwards that are part of it, that's fine.
Whose idea was it to put in Ashley Walters, Asher D, who has a bit of, you know, he's done time?
He has, yeah. I mean, he's also done a lot of time acting, which was the key decider for me. I mean, he was in a thing called Storm Damage, you know, when he was 15, a long time before the So Solid thing. He was fantastic in that. Been acting since he was 5. So, you know, obviously comparisons are drawn with the kind of experiences he's had, and he's part of a notorious group and all of those kind of things. But, you know, I was always confident that his acting ability was going to stand out and was going to kind of eclipse all those other things.
How good is he, Mark?
He's perfectly decent. I mean, I have to say, I know about, you know, modern popular music wouldn't fill the back of a small postage stamp. So if you showed me him, I wouldn't know, you know, I don't...
Maybe that's the best way to...
I've never heard a So Solid Crew record. I believe they're very good, apparently. But so I don't know. So to me, he looked like somebody doing a convincing impression of that role. However, I don't know beyond that. I mean, whether he's acting or whether... I mean, clearly he's acting. He's on screen and he's very good. But it's difficult to judge his range, because that's the only thing I think I've seen him in. And also because he's up against this young kid. How old is that little kid?
Well, he's 14 now. He's kind of 12, 13 when he was when he was in the film.
And he's just terrific. And it is that thing where you can never work with animals or children, because they'll either ruin the scene or they'll steal it. And this little kid is really, really great. But, I mean, Ashley Walters is entirely convincing in the key role. Like I said, to me, I'd never seen him before, so...
And do we leave the cinema thinking that there's a way out, that there's some kind of salvation at the end of this situation?
Yeah, without giving away too much of the plot, yeah. I mean, it was really important to deal with something like this and leave hope, because I believe there's always hope, you know. I mean, that's, you know, to leave something without any chance of redemption, I think, is to present a far too bleak picture of the way the world is, and it doesn't leave it that way.
It's interesting as well to cite Philip French's review in The Guardian as well, in The Observer again. He said that it was a possibility of saying that the ending, the message of hope at the end could be trite. But he said, but then again, thousands of Westerns end like that. And it is true. It has a kind of classic narrative arc. It ends in the right way. I mean, yes, of course, it's contrived because it's a narrative. But, you know, I think it got away with that. I think it would have been wrong, actually, for that story to have ended on a completely downbeat, bleak, nihilistic note, which I don't doubt for 1 minute that some people would demand, you know, in their authenticity means it has to end. You know, well, I do that all the time, you know. I'm sorry, if anyone's happy at the end of the film, then I don't buy it.
How much did you have to spend?
I think it ended up around $1.3 million.
Which is nothing.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's not for filmmaking terms. I mean, obviously, to you and me, $1.3 million.
Sounds a lot. But, so, was that on budget?
Well, I mean, actually, as the kind of ambitions of the film grew, the budget grew, and it grew to about $1.3 million, which is the most that the BBC and Film Council together would put in for a film of this nature.
And how much would you like to take?
Well, in the box office, yeah. Do you mean?
What would be good?
I'm not sure. At the moment, apparently we're doing really well. We're number 8 in London.
Cool.
In the box office. We started on 75 screens. It's a cutthroat market. We're still on 72 for next week. You know, it's making money. It's doing well.
Well, wish you all the best, Saul. Thanks for coming in. Now, can you do you see many of the top 10 movies? Do you see what the competition is?
Yeah, but most of them are kind of Miss Congeniality, and I've got a little kid as well, so it's quite hard to get out and see some of them. I've seen Maria Full of Grace.
Okay, well, look, jump in on any of these, because we'll do the box office top 10 before we do the preview.
Okay,
so jump in if you've seen any of them or want to express an opinion, even if it's an ignorant opinion based on, you know, not frankly.
No, it's not going to be lowering the tone, is it?
Because you might know something about the actor or the director or something, so you might instantly have an opinion straight away.
I do have a correction to make for James, but when we get to
Okay,
it.
When we get Okay, so the box office top 10 this week. Out of 10 is Downfall.
You know, it's the best movie about Hitler currently playing in a mainstream cinema. It's actually really, really interesting, and it was true, because I heard James reviewing it, and you tied him up in knots about this, was somebody saying, you know, he said, well, I know it doesn't sound like on paper it's a great idea, and somebody wrote in saying, well, what do you mean it doesn't sound on paper like it's a great idea? What sounds on, you know, but I know exactly what James meant, and he's right, but it is a very good film.
Hostage at 9?
It's rubbish. I mean, I just don't get where these moronic, you know, mainstream press critics are saying, it's a great return to form for Bruce Willis. No, it's not. It's Bruce Willis going, I haven't had a hit in ages. Everything else has gone down the toilet. Frankly, I do think the Hudson Hawk ought to be reassessed. But in the meantime, I'm going to do Hostage, which is Die Hard with me as the old guy.
I can still wear a vest.
Yeah, but he can't. That's the other thing that's funny about it, is that there is that sort of, he's no longer the Bruce Willis that did Die Hard, but his bank account clearly requires him to be. So he ends up in nonsense like Hostage. And it's shot by this French guy. So suddenly everyone says, oh, well, therefore, clearly, it's art. Il est art. Les arts.
Mais non.
Yeah, but il est les...
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yes,
but didn't actually get there. Constantine at 8.
It's everything that Rennie Harlin's Exorcist The Beginning should have been had Rennie Harlin had the slightest hint of a sense of humour. It's completely stupid and very enjoyable. And Tilda Swinton as a transsexual angel Gabriel did make me laugh out loud. And, you know, Keanu Reeves, he does what he does. He's a lunk, he looks funny with wings, and there's loads and loads of theological nonsense, and things go bang a lot.
At 7, Miss Congeniality 2.
Well, over to you, madness. Really. Have you seen
it? Yeah, no, I've seen the poster. I mean, it's impossible to...
Review the poster, then.
You know what?
It's her in the dress, and she's got the leg out of the dress, but then she's got it's rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. Miss Congeniality was all right. Sandra Bullock keeps picking absolute stinkers. They have a real problem. In the first one, she becomes the princess, and then, you know, in this one, they've got to go, oh, so she's the princess at the beginning, they have to get a bit back to being the FBI agent. It goes on for ages and ages. There's loads of outtakes. It looks like they shot forever, and it's, you know, it's just completely lumpen. Okay. And it's a shame, because I like Sandra Bullock, but I can't remember... Well, I can remember, actually. It was that thing with Nicole Kidman that she made that.
So if you want to see that leg, it's probably best to stick with Speed.
Stick with the poster, yes. Stick with the poster, stick with Speed. Or go to see another film, watch the trailer for Miss Congeniality 2, because that's got all the gags in it.
Hitch at 6.
Well, you know, I like Will Smith, and it's a funny Will Smith rom-com, you know, by the water cooler, forgettable in one ear, out the other ear comedy, and I did laugh all the way through it.
Be Cool at 5.
You know, why? Why? Well, no, I know why. I mean, presumably the figures added up, but why?
Robots at 4 lasted 45 minutes before I had to take Young'un out.
And?
He was scared.
What bit scared him?
The scary bit?
But which scary bit?
The scary robot.
I liked it, actually. I mean, I was quite enjoying it,
then I had to leave.
I thought the story wasn't great. I thought the design was beautiful.
I'm getting fed up with leaving these pictures.
I thought the design... You know what you want to do? Take him to see a really scary film, OK? Sneak him into, like, the, you know, the original Exorcist, and then go, you see, that's a scary film.
Would he like Bullet Boy, do you think, 5-year-old?
No.
No. What certificate is it?
15.
Oh, OK, now he's got a few years to wait. Yeah. Valiant at 3. Have you seen any of these, Saul, by the way?
No, none of them.
No, okay.
No, it doesn't sound like I'm missing much either.
No, but Robots looks great. It's got a lovely sort of retro 50s feel, and it's, you know, beautiful pastel shades, very nice. Valiant, you know. It's a shame because it's got some great comedians in it, but it's not very good.
Ring 2, at 2.
Right, James King. Right, now, I am really cross about this. Basically...
Well, don't go on holiday then.
No, well, I'll just, you know, I rang up from holiday... And then I was going to ring back, and I was told that that wasn't form.
Sure,
okay, fine. Here's the thing: if you know anything about horror, you understand that Ring 2 is better than Ring. Why? Ring, the remake of The Ring by Gore. Pass me that bucket, Verbinski, is a terrible film. Hideo Nakata, who made Ringu and Ringu 2, actually understands that horror is not about teenagers going, "Eh!" It's about grown-up issues, and it's about, you know, ageless terrors. There are things that are structurally wrong with Ring 2 that largely come down to the fact that it's written by the same guy who did the Ring 1 remake, but it is directed beautifully. If you've seen Dark Water, if you've seen the original Ringu, if you know about Nakata's interest in parents and children, there is at least 50 minutes of good grown-up horror in Ring 2. I'm sorry, it's a better film. The original Ring, obviously, is better than all of them.
Number one, Sahara.
It's a good, I haven't seen it.
Okay. Hey, Saul.
And who cares?
Saul, thanks very much, Steve, for coming in. Sorry you had to sit through that tirade there from Mr.
Very enjoyable.
Anyway, so go see Bullet Boy. Saul Dibbs, thank you very much, Steve. Appreciate your time. It's 10 to 4. We'll do some reviews in just a moment. It's 8 minutes to 4 o'clock. If you want to go and see Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the premiere, and go to the post-premiere party, which happens next Wednesday in London, you have to get yourself to London. But if you and a friend want to go to that, here's the question. For which geographical features did Slarty Bartfast win awards? What you need to do is go to the website, bbc.co.uk/5live. Click on the Hitchhiker's picture. And if you can't get to the web, call 0800 100 500, select option 4, you get through to a real person called Mary, and we'll take all your details and your answer. Listen on Monday, we'll give you details about how you can actually get to see it first and for free, and exactly who has won these premiere tickets. 0800 100 500, all the details on the website.
And my review on Monday, I think, because I'm seeing it Monday morning.
How splendid.
And one of my favourite lines ever comes from the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when he says, "Where are we? We're safe. Where's that? We're on a Vogon battlecruiser." This is obviously some new use of the word safe that I hadn't previously encountered.
I'm not sure that makes it into the movie, but my favourite bit from the book, which
have you
involves
seen the film?
The whale and the bowl of petunias, that does make it in. And
oh, fantastic.
More on that on Monday. Okay. What else is... Well, I said what else. Is there anything you should know about?
Well, let's do the Amityville Horror first. Okay, the Amityville Horror was, in 1979, a great big hit horror movie, despite the fact that it was panned by pretty much every critic in town. The story is a family move into a house in Amityville, with a great big house which they clearly shouldn't be able to afford, but they are able to move into the house because the house's value has crashed because the previous occupants had a terrible thing happen in the house, and consequently nobody else wants to listen in the house. Just to get you up to speed, here's a clip from the new Amityville Horror with the babysitter explaining to the kids what happened in the house before.
Did your family know the DeFeos?
The who?
The family that lived here before you.
No, we just moved here.
Well, you know what happened to them, don't you?
No.
I really shouldn't be telling you this. So this whack job, Ronnie, the guy that lived here, people in this town say he heard voices telling him to do it. The guy was a nut. I mean, first he thinks his dog's out to get him, so he kills it. A few days later, he thinks his family's a bunch of demons. So you know what he did? Wasted them. I'm totally freaking you out, kid. I suck at babysitting.
That's just the kind of babysitter that you want. And apparently,
exactly.
Is she in a bikini for no reason?
She's in, you know, I think they call them waster trousers and almost nothing else, you know. Waster as in, you know. Yes, exactly. So, if you're of a certain age, my age, you remember the whole Amityville story, which was apparently a true story, a novel by Jay Anson based on the recollections of George and Kathy Lutz, who moved into this house 1 month later, ran out screaming, "For God's sake, get out," and then documented all these things happening. Now, obviously, if you follow the story, you will also know that a few years later, it all came out. The whole thing was a scam. Okay, the guy who was indeed Ronald DeFeo Jr., who was indeed convicted and is still serving time for killing his entire family. His lawyer then later said, well, actually, the whole demonic possession thing was a story that was cooked up as part of the defense, the way of making it. It was just nonsense. We made the whole thing up. And it has indeed generated millions and millions of dollars. There have been two big screen Amityville sequels, five small screen spin-offs and TV series, now this big remake. So it has made an absolute slew of money for the Lutzes, who moved into the house in a state of cashed strapness. And it was used by the defense as an attempt to say, well, the whole thing was to do with demonic possession. So the whole story's bunk. Let's not make any bones about that. It's bunk. However, the original film had a certain amount of charm. And the reason it had charm, I think this is very well summed up incidentally by Stephen King in his book Dance Macabre, is that he says that actually it's a property horror movie that gets right under the skin of people who are old enough to understand mortgage rates. It's a without all the ghoulish trappings, it's a story about a family who move into a house that they cannot afford, and the house then literally proceeds to eat their finances. And in a great scene in the original, they actually lose a bundle of money. They put a bundle of money down on the sofa, and the house, it goes. And George Lutz ends up pulling up the floorboards, screaming at the house, where's the money? Where's the money? And it's really, it's just a film about overdrafts, about mortgage anxiety, about being, you know...
Do you know it's lost on a number of people?
Yes, well, clearly it's lost on anyone under the age of, let's say, 22, 23. But it is definitely true that the first film did have that going to it. The remake, which is directed by Andrew Douglas, who's a commercials graduate, who incidentally made a very good BBC Four film called Searching for the Wrong Eye Jesus, which I did like, is just dumbed down to the point of, you know, it's aimed at 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds. So they've taken out completely all the sort of grown-up subtext. Yes, at the beginning, the guy playing George Lutz says, you know, we really can't afford this. But then that's forgotten because they're into the house 2 minutes and people are flying out of windows and jumping off roofs and there are demonic kids everywhere and things are going bang, huge flashbacks and there's blood all over the place. It's like, it's not that the house is, you know, maybe possessed. It's the house is like a fairground ride. Now, in terms, this is from the people that brought you the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Well, the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre should clearly be buried in an enormously large pit, as it was just an obscenity and a horror, because the original Texas Chainsaw was beautiful and perfect. No one in their right mind...
It was beautiful?
It was. It's a work of great...
For another day.
As John Carpenter said, after he saw it, he went to sleep and he slept like a baby because it pacified his soul. I will continue this argument with you at another date.
Weird man.
It's a great film. The original Amityville Horror was schlock. It was nonsense. But the most amazing thing about the remake is that in comparison with the remake, the original one was really subtextually dense. I mean, after seeing the remake...
This is just dense.
Yeah, this is just... That's very good. Damn, I missed that. That's very good. Yes, from subtextually dense to just dense. But it's dropped the average age of the potential audience from 23 to 12, although it's got a 15 certificate. It's dumb, it's stupid, it has no tension. It does have a couple of scares, and it's directed like an advert for, you know, for some popular beer, okay, but only with zombies.
Do me two more movies in 90 seconds.
I will quickly do you The Interpreter, because I can't do it in less than 90 seconds. Basically, The Interpreter, Sean Penn, Nicole Kidman, upmarket thriller, directed by Sidney Pollack, who has this incredible reputation of being a great filmmaker, 3 Days of the Condor, also an actor. We saw him recently in Stanley Kubrick's last film, taken very seriously. The first film to be shot within the corridors of the United Nations headquarters in New York. This is a big deal, but it presumably explains why it is that Nicole Kidman's character every 15 minutes delivers some short pithy speech on the value of diplomacy over guns. Story is, she is a UN interpreter of the title. She overhears a plot to assassinate an African leader, but no one believes her. Everyone thinks that in fact she's covering something up. They get in Sean Penn. Sean Penn is, oh, guess what? He's playing downbeat. He's playing rugged. He's playing, you know, annoyed. He's playing a man. He's just lost his wife. She's somebody who has a terrible political past. You know she's got a terrible political past. Why? Because she's got a weird, non-regionally specific, but possibly African, can't quite make it, Nicole, why are you doing that with your mouth accent? And they all whisper a lot. They have a lot of conversations like this, and they say things like, all language is important, and interpretation is dangerous, and mean, and you go, yeah, fine. And the thing is, what? And then suddenly there's some action sequences, and it's, you know, it's fluff. I wish it wouldn't take itself quite so seriously. Catherine Keener steals the show, but it, you know, it's nothing like as important as it wants to be. Despite the fact that Kofi Annan gave it a green light.
Okay, I'm sure he did. We've run out of time. Movie of the week?
Well, you know, I mean, like, look, movie of the week, the original Amityville Horror. The original Amityville, which has just come out on DVD this week.
Thanks, bye. We'll see you Monday at 1 o'clock.